You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.
My name's Rick Kleffel, and this show is a narrative species. My guest today is Johnny Compton. He's the author of Devils Kill Devils, a wonderful book that he and I talked about. It was so good, I decided to go out and buy the Spite House and ask him to talk about it. It's his first novel. Thank you for joining me, Johnny.
Thank you for having me back on. This is going to be great. Can't wait.
As I started this novel, I mean, from the very get-go, you tell us exactly what kind of novel this is. It's a haunted house novel. You introduce us to the haunted house in the first paragraph. And one of the things you mention is the Texas Wiki about the most haunted places in Texas. Unsurprisingly, I immediately looked that up. To see, was there a specific house that you based the haunted house you created?
Not anything specific to Texas necessarily. I I'm glad you mentioned that opening paragraph, and all people really liked it. I was trying to do my pale imitation, but a Shirley Jackson impression. You know, it's Hill House, not sane, and the description of Hill House is basically a living thing, and establishing that in the first paragraph of The Haunting of Hill Houses is one of my favorite books, one of the best openings of all time, as many people have described. And so I was trying to give that impression with this opening. And so Hill House, you know, this fictional place, probably had a lot of influence on it. Specific places, not necessarily even in Texas, but it was more of harkening back to when I was a kid growing up in Mississippi. Before I came to Texas, there wasn't a specific house that I'd ever seen, but there was rumored to be this house in the woods nearby where I lived. And we would trade stories, and people would tell stories about, oh, like this mystery house back in the woods that if you ever found it and went inside, something horrible would happen to you. And of course, you know, entirely, I'm sure, fictional you know, I don't think there was ever even a house like that in those woods, but we all used to tell stories about it. And me and my friends, we knew about that place. And that's kind of what I had in mind, something just ominous, and everybody's kind of aware it's there and you're not supposed to go there. And then you just hopefully avoid it and don't have anything horrible happen to you, and you don't end up going missing based on that possibility. So yeah, that's more of what I had in mind, not necessarily a specific alleged haunted place in Texas, although there are many places in Texas that kind of echo that sentiment as well of something foreboding and allegedly haunted.
You mentioned Shirley Jackson, and I was thinking of Hill House, and also just that she was really my entryway into horror. I remember reading The Lottery as a story as a kid and thinking, oh my God, this is wonderful and awful. talk about, you know, just your first encounter as a child, and that we had a haunted house back when I lived in Covina that we would all go to. It was, you know, just an old wrecked house on a hillside, and this made me think of that as well. And you also mentioned stories, so you were part of and telling horror stories even as a child, and I think we all do too.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And this was, I mean, as far as storytelling goes, horror is, I call it my first love. I don't know if that's like literally the case, but it feels like the first stories that I truly loved and gravitated towards and couldn't get enough of and had a death grip on me were horror stories. And so when I was a kid, you know, all this is kind of fresh in mind because I just did my first ever career day. I was invited to do a career day for some elementary school students. And I haven't been that nervous about doing any kind of presentation or talk in front of anybody the entire time that I've been assigned author now. And but I was terrified because I'm like, I'm gonna go be talking to these fourth and fifth graders and they're not gonna be interested. And it turns out it was the exact opposite. They were extremely interested. It went superbly. But I got to talk to them about falling in love with horror, with scary stories as a kid, and it was really amazing to see how their eyes light up because they were all super into scary stories too. And I was like, this is, you know, with the way things go in the world, and you sit there and think, what is the future going to look like for these kids? Are they even able to read these books? Are these things going to be available? And then they were all able to name different scary books that they're reading right now. And when I got to a point, I did a PowerPoint slide, and I got to a point where I got to Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. And, you know, that there were several other books that I'd listed up there that they would have never heard of. And even some of my peers have never heard of. I mean, I was into some very off the wall, you know, kind of stuff from what I've gathered, because not a lot of my peers have heard of some of the books that I grew up reading. Oh, gosh, there was an author named Daniel Cohen who wrote a series of a kind of legends presented almost as nonfiction style of stories, or like kind of a collections. And so he wrote one called Ghostly Terrors that I really love. He wrote one called A Phone Call from a Ghost. I'm looking around to see if I have my place is a mess, but I don't know if I have a copy of either of these, like, just lying around. Oh, here we go. You know, I don't have my own book, but I do have this Phone Call from a Ghost from Daniel Cohen, because I went out and hunted down these copies because I was doing the career day and I wanted to be able to show these to the kids. And so Strange Tales of Modern America, which has some really fascinating, like, off the beaten path kind of stories, not common to a lot of people. There's one in here, if I'm correct, this is the book that has a story about a really frightening alleged demonic possession of like demonic influence in a house in Detroit, I think it was, which made me go hunt down newspaper articles about it, because he said it even made the newspapers. And allegedly it did, or not even allegedly, when I went down and hunted down the newspaper articles, I was like, oh my God, here it is, talking about from the 70s, I think it was. This, it might have been even earlier, it might have been like the 50s, but this haunted house allegedly in Detroit with a demonic possession. And it was well known then in Detroit. And if you went to look it up now, just Googling it, it's completely buried. Unless you knew to go find that house. I had to go find the specific, you know, the specific address, I think, is listed somewhere in this book. And knowing that allowed me to go find the story. Otherwise, it's just lost. And I'm like, there's so much value in, like, these kind of off the beaten path, little weird books that I used to read when I was a kid that I loved. And he wrote this, Ghostly Terrors, another one called Monsters You've Never Heard Of, which is one of the first books I ever read that I fell in love with. And it introduced me to some cryptids that nowadays I think are a lot more commonly known. But I know growing up, that was the only source for, like, the Jersey Devil, the Dover Demon, the Hairy Hands I forget what part of England it is, but there's a road in England that allegedly has hairy disembodied hands that will grab your car, grab your steering wheel, and drive you off the road. And so I was reading all that kind of stuff. And so those books were up there on the PowerPoint slide, and I had a couple of copies to distribute, and they had obviously never seen those. But Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark is still the granddaddy of them all, and it is the survivor. And when they saw that, they were like, oh my gosh, you read that when you were a kid? And I was like, yeah, like that was the book. That was the book series when I was a kid. Everybody loved those to pieces. And they're like, they're so scary. And then I showed them, you know, I can't really turn the camera to it right now without kind of destroying my entire setup here. I don't know if I'd be able to get the camera back for our Zoom meeting. But I bought a, you know, besides my lovely doll back here, my eyeless doll painting, somebody kind of drew and painted a mural of several of the Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark illustrations, a recreation of it. And that was one of the first things I bought when I, you know, to reward myself for the book deal. One of the few things that I indulged in was I wanted my office to be pretty creepy. And like that is one of the things I bought. But these are all the things that I grew up reading about. I was really fascinated with fiction, you know, obvious fiction, but also that were allegedly true hauntings really captivated me. And they still do. And this is where I draw a lot of inspiration to this day. And I wanted the Spite House to kind of feel like, going back to that opening paragraph a little bit too, and even throughout the book, I wanted it to feel like when you're reading about a place that, you know, maybe if you don't believe in ghosts, you know, this is nonsense. It's not haunted, but there's still a part of you that's like, I wouldn't stay the night there though, just in case. Even if you're a non-believer, you're just like, yeah, I still wouldn't roll the dice on what might happen to my soul if I spent the night there. So that's what I was trying to convey with the Spite House. And like, that's all drawn from these things from childhood, like you mentioned, where we all grow up really loving scary stories.
Well, as I read this book, one of the things that captured me was the characters. I mean, Eric, Des, and Stacy, in the first part, even well before they got to the house, I just was thinking, boy, I followed these people to the grocery store. So talk about coming up with these three characters. Eric is a father. He's with his two daughters, Des and Stacy. Des is a teenager. Stacy's a, you know, preteen, a 8-ish, 9-ish, maybe. And the family's black, and they've been, you know, kind of on the run. It's somewhat unclear. So talk about just creating these characters and making them so vivid and likable.
Man, I love that you love the characters so much. I really appreciate that. I gotta be honest, man. I think I just kind of am fortunate in just having, I'm a little older now. You know, I've been writing for a long time. And so I just try to make characters that you have a sense of how much they care about something, care about each other, care about something in their world, their lives. And obviously for these three, they're a very tight-knit group. As you said, they're on the run. We don't know why. That gets explained as the story goes along. Eventually that gets revealed. But I wanted it to feel like they know each other. They all have a different kind of dynamic in the relationship. They have little kind of quirky elements that hopefully help them just stand out. And I'm not a person, you know, I've been told a few times, I pack a lot of content into a relatively small space in my stories. So I'm kind of keeping things moving at a steady pace, I hope. Which means I don't sit down and have my characters have like a lot of longer exchanges necessarily, dialogue wise, or things that are just completely about character development. And yet you sneak things in, like the little game that they play, the ABC game that they play, that they invented for the road. It just felt like it's kind of loosey goosey. It's weird. It's just a quirky little family, you know, unity kind of thing. And I feel like trying to add those little elements, the little things like Des doing an impression of her dad at one point early on when they're having a conversation. It just feels like these are like the silly little family dynamic and knowing each other things that I can spice it up with and make the family feel more lived in and more real. And, you know, I mean, that's a huge compliment. I appreciate it that you would follow them to the grocery store. But I think it's because you're like, these people are fascinating. You know, in and of themselves, outside of the extraordinary circumstances governing their life, they also are just, they're interesting to be around. You know, they have little verbal tics and they know each other just well enough to have little personal digs, but they're not being aggravating. I mean, one of my things that I know there's a kind of controversial takes on unlikable characters. And I understand like the idea that likability is subjective. You don't have to necessarily have a character that you are creating that has to be, you know, the pure kind of wholesome and beloved individuals. It's great to have characters with flaws, sometimes deep flaws, sometimes outright villainy. Even if that's your main character, you can do that. Like I said, I do think there's something though about, I want you to still want to hang out with my characters and find out more. And so I do think there's a lot of value to that. And I don't think that comes down to likability as much as just, are you a compelling and interesting individual? And again, that's all entirely subjective, but I try to think about that when I'm writing, regardless of, even with, you know, I'm sure we're going to get into some of it, but with the villains of the piece, I want you to feel like, even if you don't like this person, you're still interested in what's going on with them. And you understand a little bit of where they're coming from to some degree. And I'm fascinated in writing characters, at least, you know, for my first couple of books here, I've tried to write characters that hopefully stand out in that way, that you can feel like you could follow them around just to take notes and figure out what's going on with them, because they seem like they're interesting, if nothing else, if not even fun sometimes to be around.
You know, one of the things I thought about when upon finishing the book, as you read the book, it flows really fast. It's certainly a page turner. And it feels like, you know, you're, as a writer, as a reader, you're putting together this story. By the time you finish the book, I realized it is masterfully orchestrated. It reminded me a bit of, I've been listening to a lot of classical music, so it reminded me of one of these symphonies where, you know, there are themes and strains that come up and rise down, and, you know, the volume increases, it goes down, it goes up, and you know that Ludwig or Amadeus, they knew what they were doing. They were not making it up. Did you make it up?
I mean, to a minor degree. I feel like at least for me, I'm working on my third novel, so I've got limited experience with this. So, you know, I don't want to sound like I'm the expert, but I do have. I'm not a I heard somebody use the phrase, because, you know, there's the phrases, the terms. Are you a pantser, just by the seat of your pants as a writer, or are you a plotter? Do you do an extensive outline before you get started? And then I heard someone say that they are a milestoner, which is kind of in between. Like, they have milestones, but it's not intricately detailed outlining. But you kind of know.
That's a new one on me. I like that.
I loved it. And I wish I could remember who it was that I heard use that phrase. It was at a book festival that I was listening to another author speak, and I told them I was going to steal it, and now I forgot who it was, so I can't credit them properly. But whoever it is out there, thank you for using that term, because I've been stealing it since then, because it is I think it really captures where I'm at. I wasn't fully making it up as I went along. If there are flourishes here and little detours, I love those. You know, I'm really fascinated with stories that have small detours and small scary pieces here or there. So like certain things like Stacy early on, she makes a paper bow, and we take a little detour where we find, you know, that there's a little something ominous about this paper bow that ends up being gifted to a different little girl. And it gives you some insight and some, maybe some foreshadowing into some of the nature of where things are going, but it's a super optional kind of sidebar, but I love that kind of stuff. And that's the kind of thing that, as I was writing, that's the kind of moment where I was like, what if I just veer off the beaten path and do this real quick? So I knew that I was going to have certain things happen, but that's an example of something where it's like, I can make this up as I go along. This will be pretty fun. So there are a few moments like that in the book as well, but there are also moments where I know at this stage, relative to, I think, the length of the book, how long I think it's going to be, and within this act, we need to reveal this or that. So the big reveal of the book, I knew what act and about what stage I wanted it to happen, because I knew I didn't want to save it for like the very end, because I feel like a twist ending is just so hard to pull off. And I'm not nearly there as a craftsperson yet to be able to pull it off in a way that people wouldn't guess it. I knew I had a quote unquote twist in the story, but it was like, if you give it to them early enough, you give it to the reader early enough, then the whole story doesn't feel like it hinges on whether or not they guessed it or they like it or not. And we could just kind of live with it. And all right, this is just, now it feels like just a plot development. So I had that kind of planning ahead in mind as I wrote it. I knew when I wanted to hit these certain milestones, but some of the full details were a little bit more, you know, not as strict and not as confined. So I'm not quite on the, I don't think I'm a Mozart by any stretch, but I will. I mean, like you saying that it felt like a symphony, I might have to, you know, steal that quote from you for you know, if we do a future edition release or something, that would look great for a blurb. That's awesome.
You know, one of the things that I thought was really powerful about the book was the prose was just so readable. I just could not put it down. Does this flow off the tip of your pen, or does it get revised in, you know, the writing version of those scenes in Grey's Anatomy where I have to look away?
I you know, my editing process, there's not as much rewriting the style you know, stylistically how it comes across, the readability, like you said. So far, at least, again, for me, it's been more of building up or removing certain plot beats based on what I'm feeling or what my editor suggests and what have you. But as far as like just like kind of the text and readability, you know, we have copy editors in my experience so far. And sometimes they'll ask, do you mean to do this? Because I have like certain quirks of my style that I've recognized, but like I like to repeat phrases or reword them using the same terms. And I'm doing that specifically to make a point sometimes. And I think that hopefully helps the readability, but I'm trying to do it in a way that there's a little bit of a pseudo poetic attempt of flourish there for me. You know, I don't know how successful it is or isn't, but I know that that's what I'm aiming for sometimes. And then the copy editor will be like, well, should we maybe reword it because this is a little repetitive, or is the repetition, I get a lot of those notes. Is the repetition deliberate? Like, yes, it is. And then sometimes you let it go. Sometimes you're like, you know what? I see why you might think it's a little bit too much of me indulging in my style there. Let's change up some of that. But for a lot of it, I get to keep the style, because that's, you know, what I like to write, you know, and how I like to write. And it, I think that part just kind of flows a little bit more naturally to me. And then even as I go back through my, sometimes when I go back through my edits, my brain is working too fast, and I'll notice entire sentences where I'm like, I think I'm missing like three words. Just like there was three words in a row that I thought I wrote them, and my brain said you wrote them. And I'm like, well, this barely makes sense. And I'm going back and in the context of the paragraph, I'm like, oh, I know what I was trying to say here, but at some point I had a time skip in my brain, and I jumped three words ahead. So stuff like that happens, but otherwise the style is just kind of it kind of is born that way. And I've been lucky enough so far that I get to keep it that way.
One thing that's important in any kind of horror novel is to create tension. And one of the things I think you do really well is to create tension in a variety of ways. There's a scene, it's actually the scene that you were referring to earlier, where Stacy ties a bow for a waitress in a restaurant. And what that setting that scene up is Stacy and her, or Das and her little sister Stacy, two black girls, go into a restaurant in Texas. And I mean, that sounds like a setup for a very bad joke. But what it is a setup for is a scene that is already, the second you begin, it's fraught with tension. And I think one of the things that you do when you create that bow, it's the absolute apotheosis of great horror writing, where there's one kind of tension that we're feeling but we don't want to talk about, which is two black girls in a restaurant filled with old white people. And on the other hand, there's, you know, what happens when this bow is tied, which externalizes the terror and fears that two girls feel, but doesn't do it in a way that it uses the supernatural to explore the natural terrors that we all feel.
Yeah, I mean, I particularly love that scene. And like you said, like it starts with them feeling this, and you have the, you know, this kind of clash of the tradition and the, you know, potential horrors that come with that, and then younger people and how they have to cope with that. And then the bow, like you said, it kind of transfers that tension. And Stacy, being very innocent, doesn't realize, you know, the power that she has. And this doesn't qualify as a spoiler, I would say, because this is very early on in the book. And so when she gives that bow to the waitress, the waitress brings it home, and then the bow kind of manifests, you know, it's able to draw like a spirit into the house. And that is the spirit of this little girl who gets the gift. It's her grandmother, who it turns out was a mean old lady. And so the meaner older person thing that you just mentioned that you're scared of, it instead of being a direct impact in the public setting for these two little girls, it goes back to a different little girl who has to deal with the fear she's always felt because she had this extremely mean, overbearing grandparent who is now passed on. But that spirit comes back and is just immediately, like we find out, like this was a cruel, unnecessarily kind of in a relatively short amount of time, this is an unnecessarily cruel, judgmental, older woman who already had a negative view of her very young granddaughter and was kind of blaming her for stuff. And it's just, to me, this is like, like you said, it's kind of a great way for horror to, you know, one of the beauties of the horror genre, and horror genre, and especially supernatural horror, we can take the things that scare us in the real world and reshape them in a way that's creative. And we still get to feel that fear, but kind of keep it at enough distance to where it's, I kind of consider it practice. The real world can be very scary. And I think fear is something that we should all learn to deal with, because the world is never just going to be, it's never going to let us off the hook as far as fear goes. But if we're reading horror and things like it, we can be familiar with the sensation in a different way. And so then when it comes up, it's like, okay, like, this isn't a complete blindside. I know what this feels like. And now I can process it a little better. And I can also think of, when I've read everything, how would these people behave and what kind of action would they take? And, you know, try to apply those lessons as well as you can to real life. And I feel like especially supernatural horror gives you the avenue to explore those emotions and those fears in a way, like I said, that keeps it at arm's length and feels like practice and a little bit safer, on top of hopefully being engaging, entertaining, interesting, all of the other things that I'm hoping that my books are.
Exactly. Now, another thing I think you use incredibly well throughout the novel in a variety of ways is ambiguity. At the beginning, I mean, the entire setup, when the family's, you know, out, he's looking for work, it's kind of ambiguous what has happened back there. And you do a masterful job of quelling this desire to find out immediately. We just think, okay, fine, they're on their way. He's going to get this job. The setup is, and I'm not giving anything away, Eric, Destin, and Stacy are going to stay at this house. They're the Spite House, and it's going to result in a lot of money for Eric, so he can buy his own house, and they can all live their own lives. But you do a great job of, like, kind of distracting us. And so talk about your deliberate, and there are many other scenes further into the book where things are very ambiguous, which I would prefer not to give away. But so talk about using ambiguity and the ambiguity, the flexibility that use of the supernatural tropes brings to ambiguity. I mean, makes them a lot more powerful and fun.
But so I'll reset. So some of my favorite ghost stories, being ambiguous, Stephen King's The Shining. We mentioned Haunting of Hill House earlier. And, you know, I don't even know if the house, well, I have my beliefs on whether or not the house is haunted, whether Hill House is haunted. I have other beliefs. I was fortunate enough to join a podcast and get to talk about that. The ambiguity of Eleanor's even relationship with the house and how it pertains to her history and what it means, the final fates and everything. I love the ambiguity of it so much, because we can have conversations about these kind of things. And that's part of the fun. Michael McDowell's The Elementals, extremely ambiguous, not even really sure exactly what the elementals by the end are, kind of not even really fully defined. Michelle Paver's Dark Matter, which I absolutely love. And just all of these stories that, like, kind of either employ ambiguity early on or just throughout the entire story. And like you said, especially within the supernatural horror genre, it gives you the option, like, you, I love the word that you use, the distraction. It gives you an option to kind of make you look this way because I'm doing something else with the story. And it's, you know, I get to kind of play, it's almost like a magic trick. As long as you're looking over where I want you to look and you're questioning this other thing, then it's a little bit easier for me to surprise you, obviously, because now you're not looking directly head on at what the mystery even is. I've hopefully convinced you the mystery is something entirely different, or I've layered enough mysteries with ambiguity. And some of these things I'm not going to necessarily answer the question. And I mean, the Spite House in particular was a deliberate exercise in ambiguity. By the end of the book, I kind of wanted that to be the point, was we see all of these supernatural horror stories, and sometimes there's like such a definitive answer, and I'm like, but that answer just begs more questions. And instead the story gets treated as, yep, that's the answer, you know, all done. And I was thinking, no, like that actually would just invite more questions. So what if you write a story where the entire point kind of by the end is, why are we questioning these things that we can't even really get a proper answer to anyway? So what's the purpose? And what does that do to us? Is there like a tangible damage to us if we're constantly questioning that? So that was kind of the point of the story. So I dwelled in the ambiguity a lot in the Spite House. And I think I was surprised at how many people eventually came around to it, because some of the early feedback I got was, you know, people were, I think, not quite happy with not getting as many definitive answers. But I think people have come around to understanding my intent a little bit more as time has gone on now. And it's been interesting to see people at festivals even come up and tell me how much they vibed with the idea that I left them kind of with some lingering questions about what exactly is taking place.
Well, I think, you know, that speaks to at least my interest in the genre of ghosts. I never seen anything supernatural in my life, but I consider myself a rather haunted person, and I think all of humanity is haunted, not by the spirits of the dead so much, but by the spirits of the terrible mistakes you've made and wish you could forget, and all the awful things you've caused, and all the accidents that have happened to you that you can flash back and think of, God, if I had just stepped to the left instead of the right, I would not have fallen down and smashed my head against the trash can and had to go to stitches on Black Friday. No, that would all be obvious. So talk about the you know, the idea of ghosts and haunting as existing on two levels. We all think of the supernatural level. That's lovely. But we all live with the personal level. And I think you do a fantastic job of, you know, this family is haunted from the get-go, you know, but not by, we don't know why they're haunted. And you have a lot of fun with that and all through the book.
Oh yeah. And I love what you mentioned there. You know, hauntings are very personal, and we think of them in terms of like the at least how I was introduced to them a lot of the time as a kid was like grand histories of hauntings. I mentioned the books by Daniel Cohen, and one of them, the Ghostly Terrors book, introduced me to the idea of there's a castle in Scotland, Glam's Castle, that's supposed to be haunted, one of the most haunted places in Scotland, which has a ton of ghosts as it is. So it's even, you know, the magnitude of the haunting there must be really pronounced for it to have that reputation. And yet then, like I mentioned, there's also the place in Detroit, and it's a lot more personal, and like, it's just a regular family home. And especially, I think the era of horror that brought it a little bit more into the modern times, when Rosemary's Baby and Thomas Tryon's The Other and The Exorcist, and they took them out of those castles and took the idea of the supernatural hauntings or demons or what have you, excuse me, and brought them into just ordinary households a lot more. And instead of the haunting being like, oh my gosh, Marie Antoinette still roams the halls of whatever palace she was in, and she's headless and whatnot, and these things I would read as a kid, it's like, and then you read other stuff that's like, this is just somebody's ordinary two-bedroom plain Jane house. And like, when you'd read about the Amityville Horror, which we all know is a grand hoax now, but still, I remember when I was a kid, it was like the most terrifying thing I'd ever heard of. And it just, because it's an ordinary looking house in a regular neighborhood, and this can be haunted too. And so I think bringing it to that personalized level of something that feels mundane and ordinary, that's one element of it. And then, like you said too, it kind of is representative of the mistakes that we know we've made, our personal histories, our personal past. And it kind of ties into that ambiguity, because on one hand, we can tell ourselves, yours was a very specific, direct example, personal example to you, don't take a step to the left or the right and then trip and fall. But then you just don't, you can't prove a negative, right? Like, So we don't 100% know what exactly would happen if we did the other thing. We can be 99% sure in some cases. Other cases, we're like 50% sure. Like, I don't, and then we don't know about all the times we narrowly avoided catastrophe. We have no clue. You know, there are times that I've been walking down the stairs of my house, and I know I've slipped and fallen once before, and it freaked me out because I barely caught myself before I really tumbled down the stairs, and who knows what would have happened. I don't know how many other times I was like a half inch away from a fall where I didn't even feel the slip, and a half inch away from a fall that I wouldn't have caught myself because maybe I had my computer in my hands. Maybe I had my hands full with laundry and I wouldn't have been able to grab the rail that time. And instead I'm just going to fall and who knows what kind of injuries I suffer. And I don't even know. I have no idea, you know, and that to me is like the idea of what we are haunted by. If we really start analyzing it and getting into that ambiguity, it's so much scarier because I feel like ghosts represent that possibility of like, this is what could happen to you. We don't even know what couldn't have happened. We can't prove the negatives. We just kind of have to process. I'm aware that these are the decisions I've made and these are the outcomes of those decisions and I'll be haunted by those. And yet at the same time, I'm also haunted by decisions I didn't make that I don't even know. And maybe I'm blessed by some of those decisions that I didn't make and I don't even realize that this is the thing that might have saved my life. And if I'd made that, you know, when I went out to go grab some coffee one day and I forgot my keys. Or not forgot my keys. Well, maybe I did. Maybe I forgot my keys when I walked out to get to my car, had to go back into the house. And that 20 extra seconds kept me from getting into an accident. I've no clue. And this is what I feel like is kind of represented by spirits, these alternate, you know, the idea of the spirit and the idea of this additional life and trying to relive it and trying to set things right. You know, so many times we read about in the stories of spirits and the unfinished business and all these different things. And it just kind of all ties in together in my mind of this is just the ethereal nature of existence. When you really kind of get into all these different possibilities, like you said, I just think there's so much fun to explore there with the style, you know, with ghost stories. And you know, ghost stories, again, are probably my first love. And so I think I've always been kind of fascinated by that concept.
You know, you early on referred to some of the antagonists and the villains in this novel. They are wonderful and superb, and I think you really do a good job of, we have some amount of sympathy for, you know, the devil, as it were, given how nasty they were. So talk about creating them. Who came first? Was it Eunice or Paul Masson? Or there are two other antagonists that I will remain silent about.
fair enough. You know, that is a great question, because as I think about it, I guess Eunice came first properly in terms of an actual fictional creation of my own. Paul is inspired by a short story, part of Paul anyway, is inspired by a short alleged haunting that, again, I read from Daniel Cohen in his book Ghostly Terrors, not this one, but Ghostly Terrors. In the last story in Ghostly Terrors, there's this story about this priest in this small town, and when he dies, he apparently was holding in all this repressed anger and evil. And so as the funeral procession is leaving, the people in town, this is allegedly a true story, I think it supposedly happened in Ireland or something like that, they see him walking back home, his ghost, on the side of the road, and that freaked me out as a kid. And then apparently he stopped at his old house where his mother was living. She came to the door, saw his spirit glaring at her through the window. He doesn't say anything. He doesn't come inside, and she just faints. But he was just holding this animosity in, and he just wanted to get one. He came back from the dead to get one last look at her, just to like, so she could see, like, I've been, you know, probably having to put on a public appearance of how much, you know, friendly I am and what have you. I'm a man of the cloth, etc. But really, I've been holding this in all this time. And when I was a kid, I read that. I was probably like 7 years old. It just blew me away. And it's always been in my mind. And so when I was developing Paul, or Peter rather, Masson, I didn't realize that this is what it is until, like, I was like, oh, this is where this is coming from. But years before that, the Eunice character and her character arc and her inspiration, I thought of that and actively, like, just a completely kind of spontaneous idea. I thought of that, I want to say I was in my early 20s, and I remember writing that down as a note of, like, oh, I want to develop something with a character like this. And when I originally thought of her, I actually thought of her as the protagonist of a story. And then eventually when I got to writing The Spite House and I realized this is where I wanted to incorporate her, it was like, well, she's going to be a little bit more of the antagonist. Now, interestingly, at least to me, when my first draft of The Spite House, Eunice was still the antagonist, but she was even more sympathetic. And I gave it to my one and only beta reader so far that I've ever used. And I gave it to her, somebody I've known for a long time and I trusted. And she was like, this is a great story. I really love it. I hate Eunice, though. And she said it in like a, not like I hate this character, but like, I can't like, as a human being, if she was a real human, because what she does to this family, and she's so selfish. And I was like, really? Like, I was expecting more sympathy. She was like, no, she crosses lines. I can't forgive. And I just thought, this is interesting. And then by the time it got through her and some of my editors, and everybody kept giving me the same feedback of, man, Eunice is kind of, she's so messed up for what she eventually does. And so I eventually was like, well, if everybody kind of feels this way, I'm going to try to keep some of this sympathy, but let's lean more into her villainy. So she ended up becoming more villainous because of the feedback I got, because I was like, I realized, like, I'm not going to have her not cross the line that she crosses. That's the whole point of the story. But to everybody else, they're seeing how, like, her crossing that line, what it means. And so I said, let's, you know, kind of develop her in a different way than I had originally intended, to make her villainy and her selfishness stand out a little bit more. And I think that ended up being to the benefit of the story and to the benefit of the character. So I feel like it made her more memorable. But that original bend of her being a little bit more sympathetic comes from the fact that when I first thought of her back in my early 20s for that story and her path, I thought she was going to be the protagonist of an entirely different focus of a story. And it's just interesting to see how that journey develops.
One of the things I thought that was so powerful about the book was, as a reader, when we're reading a story, we really like to think that, you know, we can kind of get ahead and figure out where things are going to be. And I think that, and then the real satisfaction is if you kind of have an inkling as a reader that, well, this is going to turn out this way, this is kind of odd, and then the author pulls some kind of sleight of hand and you go, oh my God, I was right. And I think that this requires a real mastery on the author's part to give us the clues, but also keep us doubting at the same time, so that when the reveals you talked about happen, they're super, super satisfying. So it's, as I said, it was a very musical part that you know, it's I would say, you know, like the guitar solo in Layla. You hear, you know, you're listening to that song, you think these are two of the greatest guitar players ever, and the song is really, really good, and you're following the song, and all of a sudden this solo comes out and you think, this is what I was waiting for.
You didn't even know you were waiting for it, right? It's just kind of like, oh man. I mean, I love that you use the term sleight of hand. And I mentioned earlier, like, a magic trick. The one thing, because I do feel like this is a trap sometimes writers want to fall into, and I'm not going to name anything specifically, but there have been some very high profile stories in pop culture and I think, you know, the last 10 years or so, that literally we found out that the direction of the story changed because you know, it was like a TV series, let's say, and they realized that the audience had kind of figured out where the story was going, and they wanted to fool the audience, and so they changed things, and then it didn't make sense necessarily. The cool thing about a magic trick, they usually tell you, or they you know what's going to happen. If he says, I'm going to saw this woman in half, he's going to do that. And then the point of a magic trick usually is not to completely lie to the audience. We all know the sleight of hand. If he says, you know, pick a card, we have a mutual understanding. You're going to figure out the card. Now, how you end up displaying it might be like something I didn't expect. But I'm also, at the same time, if I pick the Three of Clubs, there's a part of me that knows you're going to show the Three of Clubs. I'm going to look at it. I'm not going to show you. I'm going to put it back in the deck. You're going to do whatever you do. And then you might misdirect me a little bit and distract me. But I know the Three of Clubs is eventually, you're going to show me that. And I'm going to be still impressed. You're not going to lie to me. You're not going to say, actually, the whole time, this wasn't even what this was about. I'm going to do an entirely different thing with the trick. The whole point of magic is to give people kind of what they anticipate and expect. But you just do your showmanship and your creativity and your imagination does it in a way where they're still startled. And so I love that you said that, because that is the point, is to have people reading the book and thinking, oh, I think I know where this is going. He's going to show me my card, and I've seen my card. But then eventually when I do show it, it's still like, wow, like that was pretty cool nonetheless. Like that to me is the objective. It's not to try to outsmart, outwit, you know, and completely fool your readers. Because a lot of the time you got to cheat, I feel like, to do that. And I don't want to feel like I've cheated anybody of anything. I want you to know, hey, I'm going to make XYZ disappear. And I told you that's going to happen. Keep your eyes locked here. And then I'm going to make it disappear. You knew it was going to happen, but I still want you to be impressed even after I've pulled off the trick. So I love that you mentioned sleight of hand, because that is very much the way I think of like writing a mystery. You have to keep things on the up and up and be, you know, honest with your audience. And they'll still be impressed if you pull it off successfully enough. It's okay. You don't have to lie to people about what you're trying to do. And you don't have to deliberately manipulate your story in a way that like the killer or what have you, the big reveal is something so left field that they didn't even have a chance to guess it. Because who in their right mind would have ever thought it was this? And that's like kind of besides the point. At least in my opinion. So I really appreciate that compliment. And man, you got me going there. I apologize. I know I'm saying a lot there, but
one of the things about the haunted house story is it bears a lot of semblance to you know, a mystery, just a straight up mystery where, you know, there's going to be there's a crime committed, and obviously with the spy house, there's definitely a crime committed. And one of the crimes is the design of the house itself. It's utterly brilliant. It's out of has ever done that before. So talk about, you know, did you draw the house before you wrote the book, or why you wrote the book?
You know, I didn't, and I should have. I should have at least tried. But I've got to thank Jeffrey Allen Love, the artist who did, because I had it drawn in my mind. I had a very clear mental picture of the house, because it's an amalgam of a few different actual spite houses. I read this article about spite houses, and I was blown away by the idea of somebody building a house purely out of spite. Couldn't believe real people did this. Thought this would make a wonderful setting for a haunted house story. And then there are multiple houses that I kind of pieced this together as, and it kind of has this crooked house weirdo feel to it. And then I couldn't believe when I saw the book cover, and I was going to be grateful for whatever I got. It was my first book. I was just going to be happy. But there was a part of me inside that was like, I really hope they don't give me like kind of generic haunted house book cover. Because the shape of the house matters so much in the book. And it's going to be very telling if the cover of the book is just like an ordinary looking house that has the lights on and it's ominous with the moon or whatever. And instead, Jeffrey Allen Love gave me this cover, and I was like, this is the house. This is what it looks like. I'm kind of glad I didn't draw it, because I couldn't have drawn it better than a professional artist, obviously. It's exactly what I wanted the house to be. I mean, exactly. It's weird. It's narrow. It's crooked. It's got this external bulge. And again, all this stuff is like stuff that I was inspired by, like various spite houses. And so I had this pictured in my mind, and then it was even, like you said, like the way the house gets developed. And to me, the redirect, one of my favorite things about the story, we can't really get into spoilers per se. One of the things I don't get to talk about too much, but I just want to like at least allude to, is kind of the redirect of the spite. And we get a reveal of who the house is really spiting, and who has kind of therefore then embraced that emotion that is in the house. And I think that manifests by the end of the story. And, you know, we find out early on who the house was initially built to spite. But then we realize, based on a confrontation between certain characters as revealed in a kind of a flashback, there was eventually a different set of people that the house came to spite. And this is, to me, again, kind of the moment where you realize, like you said, try to make some of our villains a little bit sympathetic, where you understand where they're coming from. But this, to me, was Peter's moment where we realize he's crossed the line. The people he's punishing for what he feels like is a travesty, these are some of the most innocent people and people that he should be caring the most about. And instead, he is spiting them on top of wanting to spite the others who might have actually wronged him. So like all of those kind of things came together as far as like the shape of the house, and it's malformed and weird and almost has this tumorous outside section to it. I had it in my mind. I didn't draw it. And I was very fortunate that the cover of the book kind of gives you exactly what was in my head. And so if you're struggling to picture it, picture that. It is 100% what I wanted it to look like.
Is there any talk of this yet being adapted into a movie or a TV series? I can imagine somebody that there's many directors would die to put this together. speaking metaphorically, of course.
No, well, I know, but I'm knocking on wood over here. We've had some talks. It's a process, man.
Yeah.
I'm learning that the whole Hollywood kind of and film production world, it's a lot of like, boom, we're doing stuff, things are active, and then you don't hear from anybody for like 3 months, and then all of a sudden it's like, hey, we're doing stuff again, and it's like, what the hell, what's going on? That said, I'm grateful for the people that have shown interest so far, and the fact that it's even made it as far as it has in the process. I know a lot of people don't get that far. I'm not at liberty right now, unfortunately, because I haven't made a public announcement yet. So I'm not at liberty to even say who might be attached. But I mean, we've had some legitimate people on the production side. We have an actor potentially attached who's been very involved in the discussion as well.
I can imagine. What fun.
It's been very interesting. And like I say, it's a matter of, I'm learning not to get overly excited about those kind of things, because you find out, wow, this person's interested. And then it's like, well, you know, it's Hollywood. So like that person, that actor is like interested, but then also they've got to go shoot something for 4 months.
Exactly.
So like, you know, they're busy, and it's like, oh, right. They've got a whole other slate of things, because everything is in production out to like, two or three years in advance usually. And so it becomes a matter of like, oh yeah, like you can't just assume like, oh, we're full speed ahead because you heard this person's involved or this person wants to be involved. You have to kind of think, okay, wait for them to make the space for us to talk again and figure out where we're at in the process. So I'm learning to navigate that still, but it's been fun. And there have been some discussions.
Well, I have to say that it's got some really heavy duty competition in the novel itself, which is very rewarding, and it's going to be hard to beat that reading experience. You're working on a third book. How far along are you? What do you feel comfortable about talking about it?
Sure,
is that you're doing?
I'm basically writing the ending right now. I am just kind of rehashing, revisiting what I want to do with that ending and make sure I hopefully stick the landing with it. It is it is another horror book. It's kind of blended with a detective noir story. So kind of in the vein of like Angel Heart.
Mm-hmm.
If anybody's familiar with that film or originally a book called Falling Angel that I have on my bookshelf over here.
William Hertzberg.
Really good book. Yes, William Hertzberg. Exactly. Yeah. Like I love that film, love that book. And so it's takes some direct inspiration in some respects from what happens there. And it's my I wrote my ghost story book, and I wrote my my vampire book with Devils Kill Devils, and so this is my witch's book. It eventually kind of involves witchcraft and some spells and stuff. And so I'm realizing, I didn't even think about this until I started working on the book, and I was like, I'm kind of making my way through my horror villains and tropes in, you know, this cycle of my first, you know, the books I'm allowed to write here. So I'm pretty grateful for that. And one of these days, hopefully I'll get to, knock on wood, I'll get to write my favorite, I think, monster. Somebody asked me recently what my favorite monster might be, or favorite horror entity. And I think it's the werewolf. And I don't have a good werewolf idea, but hopefully I'll come up with one, because I'd love to write a werewolf book. Probably not next, but like if my fifth book was a werewolf book, because I've already got a fourth book planned and I'm signed for, and that will be a different thing entirely as well. But I'd love to write a werewolf book.
I'd love to read it. I've been talking with Johnny Compton. His first novel is The Spite House. His new novel is Devils Kill Devils. Thank you for joining me, Johnny.
Thank you, Rick. Wonderful to talk to you again.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.